Good morning. I welcome you this morning. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. I should just about have this memorized by now. This means that our invitation is to all and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. Our reading is from the book that I'll be talking about, and the title is Calling In. I'll tell you more about that in a second, but I invite you to hear this as something to ponder. So what do I mean by the phrase calling in? We are constantly making choices about how we walk through life. Choosing how we interact with the people we meet, whether it's in person or online, whether we agree with them or disagree. The choices people make are often limited by the choices they believe they have. But instead of telling you how to live your life, I'd rather tell you how I'm trying to live mine. For much of my life, I had no real trust or patience for others. I reacted with fear or domination, caring only about protecting myself. I would call out others at the drop of a hat, whether it was for a real insult or an honest mistake. I was a loaded shotgun looking for an excuse to pull the trigger. And I had to learn to be different, to approach others with less anger and with more love. That's the simple definition. A call in is a call out done with love. After months of talking with the center's counselor, I tried trying to explain how my trauma was scorching me inside. I knew I wanted to practice compassionate politics and improve my emotional literacy to better align my feelings with my integrity. At the most despairing moment in my life, I was learning that I had choices, and I wanted to learn how to choose better ones, ones that represented who I was inside. I'd been letting my fears compromise my integrity. I didn't like that. I wanted to do something different. In the absence of suggestions from you as to what we might talk about when we get together, I have taken it upon myself to chase down topics that I am in desperate need of. This is one of those days. I learned about this book. It's Calling In, and the subtitle is How to Start Making Change with Those You'd Rather Cancel by Loretta Ross. I learned about it on public television, which is where I learn about just about anything I know. Ms. Ross is a lifelong human rights activist and author who spent many years of her adult life on the flip side of this coin. The flip side of calling out is calling in is calling out. This is what we do when we rant on Facebook about this and that, and then don't bother to read the responses, which, of course, no one here does. No. Although it seems like Facebook and maybe some of the others that I don't have go at politics and social commentary with a sledgehammer, Ms. Ross was forced up a little bit to say what she wants to say far better than I could. Now, to be clear, she is in no way claiming to have moved from her left-wing stance on to the middle so as to appease those that she would rather cancel. And I would like to use her words to describe where she's coming from. She says the terms cancel culture and call-out culture have become a political Rorschach test. Since Trump's first run for president, the right has bemoaned cancel culture even as they have as they seek to ban more books, more history, more art, and more ways of living than anyone else. They don't teach the history of America because they want to repeat the sins. Mispronouns and feminism, while they lack any discernible agenda for addressing the country's problem. Stroking the outrage call and call-outs are an easy target for the. We live in a call-out culture, she says. And of course, the internet is the prime culprit. For me, I have decided that the internet is no place to discuss issues facing our culture because it isn't a conversation. Still in all, every month or two, I will send as snarky a call-out letter to Glenn Grothman, my congressman, or Ron Johnson, berating them as eloquently and as succinctly as I can. In fact, I usually pitch it in about 36 fonts so that even if they don't read it, they might notice it on a staffer's desk as they walk by. I receive a cordial thank you form letter from both of them for caring me. And in fact, other than making me feel a little better than if I didn't do it. Ms. Ross might even call it legitimate to do that, as you'll see. She sees the call for making people relate to the community with people we might not agree with, distancing us from others and suffering emotionally as a result. This is clearly how she started. She tells a moving story of the sexual abuse when she was young that changed the trajectory of her life and set her on a path of advocacy and activism. Here's how she got to this calling in place. When she was in her 20s, she was running a rape crisis center in Washington, D.C., when she was contacted by a convicted rapist from prison who wanted her to help him stop his compulsion towards sexual violence. Her agency had never worked with a perpetrator before, only victims. And her curiosity got the best of her. Their work had not stopped anyone from getting raped. She wanted to learn about the mind of a rapist because she too had been that victim. His name was William Fuller. She visited him in prison, and it's a longer story, but the result was a sexual violence support group that was started in lockup and a relationship of understanding and insight that in a way had its roots in restorative justice, which she mentioned several times. Restorative justice is simply based on the principle that victims are seldom restored in a retributive system. And by creating an opportunity for victims and perpetrators to meet, and for the perpetrator to hear the impact of their actions, they do get a chance to atone, but that's not the first priority. The first priority is that the victim gets a chance to be heard. But this was an event that paved the way for Ms. Ross to begin considering what calling in might look like. Their advocacy work had always been with victims, and when they took to the streets or the halls of legislature, their work was always a calling out. And she began to realize it was seldom effective. She says this, people opposed to human rights, opposed to ending poverty, addressing racism, or accepting women's rights to control their bodies, they think they're fighting the human rights movement, but I believe they're wrong. They're fighting truth, history, and evidence. And most importantly, they're fighting time. These existential forces are beyond their power to command. With truth, history, evidence, and time on our side, we hold the winning hand despite our fears of powerlessness and failure. But, she says, my biggest fear is that despite our winning hand, we'll be defeated, at least in our lifetime, because we can't stop calling each other out. She says, I've learned a better way. We can skip the viral shaming and reputational warfare. We can skip the ideological litmus tests that don't help build a diverse coalition. Whether persuading another individual or launching an entire cultural movement, Real change requires bringing people in. Even people you'd expect not to need or not to be able to reach. She says, this is why I've come to embrace calling in. Now, I think I'd like to inject myself a little bit into all of this, because I am realizing that there are a couple of things that seem common to nearly all of the things that we've been talking about the last couple of years that I've been coming here. Whether it's family systems theory or forgiveness or trauma or even Black Lives Matter and climate change, two things are true, I think. One is that step one is I need to get this stuff into my head. And I've been learning a lot thanks to you. But the other half of step one is to realize that real change doesn't happen for me up here. It doesn't happen until it descends, and this is my language, into the heart. That's the place where I change. The second truth about all of this is this. Before I can change the world, I've got to call myself in. I want to pull a line out of the opening passage that I read, and I probably will end up repeating that whole thing. She said, the choices people make are often limited by the choices they think they have. And then she adds this, instead of telling you how to live your life, I'd rather tell you how I'm trying to live mine. After her wrestling with what she was learning from the sexual predators she met in prison, she says this. After months of talking with the Rape Crisis Center counselor, trying to explain how that my trauma was scorching me inside, I knew I wanted to practice compassionate politics. Isn't that a great phrase? And improve my emotional literacy to better align my feelings with my integrity. At the most despairing moments of my life, I was learning that I had choices, and I wanted to learn how to choose better ones, ones that represented who I was inside. I'd been letting my fears compromise my integrity. I didn't like that, and I wanted to do something different. So for me, what I'm learning here is that the calling out culture is essentially reactive. Somebody says something stupid online, something on the news sets me off, and I react, often quite eloquently, I would suggest, but ineffectively, and achieving perhaps the opposite of what I set out to do. So what I hear her saying is that calling in is a strategy, and it's a strategy that takes forethought and intention, not reaction. So let's look at how it works. She first talks about call-outs. She says that before the internet, call-outs generally were the result of a power differential and worked from the top down. But, as Ta-Nehisi Coates says, since now anyone with a Twitter handle or a Facebook account can become a publisher, banishment has become ostensibly democratized. I like that too. So she says that step one is to read the room. She lists five C's, which she describes as a spectrum of accountability measures to help us figure out how to respond depending on the situation. They are calling out, and she says there is a place for that. Canceling, calling in, calling on, which she describes as asking people to do better, but without investing your time and energy to help them change. And then calling it off. She says that call-outs are most effective when they target powerful people because our reach beyond our powerful people beyond our reach, and when public scrutiny is a strategic weapon we deploy against the unreachably powerful. I'm not sure that works anymore, but it's a worthy concept. Calling out may be appropriate, but she says it should never be the tactic of last resort or first resort. It ought always be the tactic of last resort. And here's some other things she says about call-out culture. Aggressive victimhood is the familiar ploy of people who push at the limits of free speech and then claim victimhood when the people they've punched down fight back. Social media amplifies human emotion, positive and negative, because its economic models are designed to capture our attention through outrage for profit. This is important. And while technology has made rapid leaps, our emotions have not. It's easier to build an outrage posse with a 280-character attention span than to construct a healing society of people who care about each other too much to choose to be cruel. That's what that was. The call-out culture means you get to discriminate in favor of those who agree with you. But, she says, tribalism is tribalism, whether it's on the left or the right. And a call-out culture makes our tribes smaller and more impotent. Loyalty to the tribe becomes more important than coexisting peacefully with others in a pluralistic culture. Calling out creates shame, and it sucks all the air out of the room. She says we've mistaken rudeness for rigor. It should be the tactic of last resort. And here's the one that stops me in my tracks. We have to accept the fact that we can't change other people, but we can change how we view them. This is where my check-in begins and where my resistance becomes inflamed. So here's some of what she says about calling in. She says, I'd like to say that a call in is a call out done with love, but it's also something else. It's a strategic choice. I have to be more motivated by winning than by proving the other person wrong. Winning then can create allies. But then, she says, is winning always the goal? Most of the time we're dealing with people close to us. Rather than winning, perhaps the real goal is being able to lean in closer. She talks of beginning with what we have in common. I remember an old marriage counseling technique that suggested that instead of starting the conversation with me against you, that we come from the place of you and me working against the problem. Perhaps from different angles, but working together. Of course, this requires that we might be able to agree on what the problem is, but if we can, then we have a starting point. A model she invokes and describes, she calls servant leadership. It's the kind of leadership that empowers others, prioritizes their growth and the well-being of all. She talks about not gaining power over, which is a call-out maneuver, but power with. So how does it work? Well, it's going to be helpful to realize that her context for using these techniques is usually in doing social justice work with organizations, particularly organizations that are trying to build a coalition, or when she's leading awareness workshops. And she might run into the typical contrarian who wants to undermine the whole presentation. She's got some pretty cool stories about that in there. For you and me, we're more likely to encounter potential calling in situations, say at a family reunion or in the neighborhood or at work. And if you are involved in human rights organizations and you struggle to get things done working with other organizations, I highly recommend that you read this book. So here are some of the steps that she suggests for calling in. Start with the self. What do you do when someone has just let their tongue run wild, she says? Well, first pause. Check your heart rate. Check your fear of danger. But if we've been working on ourselves, we know these things, she says. Self-assess. And she says, if your feelings are negative, you're not ready for a call-in. But if you have a reserve of positivity, she says, go to step two, which is calibrate the conflict. She says, conflicts are like icebergs. You can see some of it, but there's a whole lot more that you can't see. And she suggests asking three questions. One, has anyone been harmed in this exchange? Two, if so, has it been intentional? And three, has it perhaps been the result of ignorance, stupidity, or miscommunication? If yes to all three, she says it's call-out time. If it's head for a fight or possible embarrassment, she says deflect or call it off. Three, lead with love. Ask clarifying questions. Tell me more about where you're coming from. And communicate that you're willing to grow in the exchange. Four, accept the reaction. The goal of calling in is that people be with us, not necessarily agree with us. Listening is critical. And then reach a resolution. And she bases her conversation about this on restorative justice and what she calls transformative justice principles. She says restorative justice is not about getting even, but getting well. It's about finding forgiveness by bringing perpetrator and victim together. And then finally, she says, communicate to these people, to folks, there's a spot for you in the movement if you ever want to join us. Now, she includes steps to take when approaching conflict, steps for when conflict is underway, steps for when conflict is over. She talks about how one creates a call-in culture in here, and when she speaks here, particularly in regards to family and friends, she says yet another thing we don't want to hear. But she says, don't think you're going to change anyone's mind. She says, don't manage their emotions. Try and manage your own expectations. The goal is not to agree with each other so much as it is to stay in relationship with each other. And three points she lists for calling in family or friends. Don't respond directly to their words. Take a moment to calm yourself. And this one, I think, has a little snark to it, but I kind of like it. She says, remind them of their inner goodness that you'd like to see more of. There's more about apologies and atonement, about communicating when we've been hurt, about creating a call-in culture. But she concludes her book with this. If you are peacefully aligned with your values, you can talk to anyone and take joy in the messiness of us all stumbling through being human together. I'll read that again. If you are peacefully aligned with your values, you can talk to anyone and take joy in the messiness of us all stumbling through being human together. So let's take a deep breath and see what we want to talk about. And see, I would call that calling in. Okay. Because it's a tell me more. It's give me feedback. It's building the relationship between you and that person. And if, you know, calling out is C minus, see you next semester. You know, that's, to me, that the comments on the paper that, you know, you didn't, this was well written, but it didn't have anything to do with what we talked about this semester. That's what I got in seminary a lot. A minus. The minus was because it had nothing to do with what we talked about, but it was well written. I mean, but that was where the conversation ended. So that's a call out. When the conversation ends, that's a call out, I think. And but if the feedback enhances conversation, I would call it calling in. So I'll tell you a quick story. I was out for a run one day on my road, and some folks up the road had just bought a house, and he was out working in the yard, and he had a bunch of wood that he was doing something, and none of us could figure out what it was, and he was out there working, so I stopped and talked to him. And we had a great conversation. They were new in the neighborhood. They didn't know where anything was, and she came out, and we were having this wonderful conversation, and they wanted to know about their dock, and I said, come see my dock, you know. And what I didn't see was their Trump sign laying down on the ground that they had taken out when they were doing their woodwork. And I said, come down on Saturday. And I'm absolutely sure that they came down on Saturday and saw my Kamala sign in the yard and just kept driving and weren't going to talk to me again. But then later, a couple months later, a tree fell on their house. And she's in Chicago and he's in Minnesota. And I had the phone number. And I said, I don't know if anybody told you, but a tree fell through your roof. And she needed me to get into her house and take pictures of stuff. And she needed me to be her neighbor. And I came home, I said, honey, I just actually accidentally made friends with a Trumper. I didn't mean, what do I do? And it's, but I think we're going to be friends. I don't know if we'll ever get to the point of talking about our yard signs, but I was kind of surprised that it could happen. Well, I think she would say, what can you work on together? What can you build together? You know, where is the common ground? What do you agree on that you can put your weight behind and build around that? Because we're never all going to agree with each other. And I think we act like we're going to. And that's nuts. Well, and that's what Ms. Ross discovered when she got into prison with this guy and they started building these groups together. They found out, and I think we said it last time we were here, hurt people, you know. Victims become perpetrators, and it's a cycle to be busted up. I heard an interview on television someplace, public TV maybe, that really struck me, and it was just kind of a sidebar thing, but it was a fella who was a Trumper, and he was asked why he was a Trumper, and he said, I have all these college-educated friends who keep telling me I should have done something better with my life, but I'm a truck driver, and I'm happy to be a truck driver. And the people I hang out with over here, they're fine with that. You know, they're not always trying to talk me into something else. And I have to, every once in a while, I have to remind myself that I'm an overeducated white man living in the Midwest with having had breakfast this morning. That's a perspective that not everybody shares. And maybe the reason this isn't even as bad as it was in this country in the 1860s when the Civil War was going on. And maybe what hasn't happened is we haven't hit bottom like they did.